We just a few minutes ago, as we read the sixth of the seventh principles being supported by the congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Association, noted that the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all is one of our goals. We want to be world citizens, living in a peaceful, free, and just world community. That is a vision which I think most of us share, even if some have not devoted much time to thinking about it. The last words of Alfred Lord Tennyson's hymn, which we just sang, get a bit more specific, indicating that the goal is the Parliament of Freedom and Federation of the World. He is talking about a democratic federal world government, a world federation with a world parliament. Is that a goal which we Unitarian Universalists all would readily like to see fulfilled? I hope so. And I hope to persuade all here that it is the right long-term goal for us, even if it is not something which we are likely to see accomplished even in the next 75 years. Political change is gradual and difficult, but it is real and among the most important and lasting kinds of improvement humans can ever bring about. Note how Tennyson speaks of bringing an end to all warfare and militarism. What a vision that is. But let's take a moment to look back on the great progress humanity has already made. It seems that our first Homo sapiens, or modern human ancestors, living in Africa 200,000 years ago, lived in small groups as gatherers and hunters, much as chimpanzees do. What is generally viewed as the first great transition in the lifestyle of humans is the agricultural or Neolithic revolution, which occurred separately in different parts of the world in the period from 12,000 to 4,000 years ago. The key change was the planting and use of grains, wheat, rice, millet, and corn in different parts of the world. But in each case, it produced a reliable, easily preserved food supply. Think about the way that meat and other things don't last very long without refrigeration, which of course they didn't have. But grains will last centuries if they are just kept dry. So this meant that they had a reliable food supply, but it also meant remaining in one place rather than living a nomadic lifestyle while hunting various wild animals. As a result of staying in one place, many other major changes took place. Permanent residences made of stone and wood were built instead of living in tents and temporary shelters. Property could now be accumulated. Towns and cities were developed. and some of them even became relatively large. At the same time, 75 to 80% of the population were still involved in agricultural production, and it took a lot of time and a lot of hard work. Formal governments were established in these settled areas. Competition between communities and wars between these various settlements began, along with the development of armies to fight wars. Before long, empires were established in Sumeria, Egypt, Babylon, China, and in Middle America. Another new thing, writing, was invented, and formal education was established for the first time. Significant divisions in society began between the few who had learned how to read and write and the many who had not. The possession of a written language and having cities is still the main way of distinguishing between civilized societies and those which are not yet civilized. At this time also, animals were domesticated and were used to help do the work that had to be done in the fields, as well as providing food. Trading developed between communities, and professional skills became important, especially working with metals. For centuries, the basic lifestyle of humans changed little and only very gradually from that time on, until the second great transition in the way in which humans live. The second great transition in the lifestyle of humans is the quite recent Industrial Revolution, whose changes we are still experiencing. It began in the last part of the 18th century in England as a result of humans gaining knowledge of how nature works and then using that knowledge to make machines. That's the key to the Industrial Revolution, making machines to help us do our work. And the first machines helped us do our physical work. But then, in my lifetime, we developed machines that do our intellectual work for us, called computers. And now, we are putting the two kinds of work together to produce robots. Still part of the Industrial Revolution. There were important developments that prepared the way for the Industrial Revolution, such as the creation of the printing press with movable type, a very important development, the increasing use of national languages, partly as a result of being able to read, and breaking of the power of the church, which had controlled intellectual thought and political power up until the time of the Reformation. The Industrial Revolution led also to a new level of competition between some nation states for control of the whole world, with Britain establishing its dominance about 1900. I suppose most of you have heard that expression used by the British, the sun never sets on the British Empire. That was 1900. The prevailing viewpoint went from nationalism in the period 1500 to 1850 to internationalism starting about 1850. The first international organizations were created to control navigation on the Rhine and then on the Danube. But in about 1975, of course, all these dates are just general about when that happened. About 1975, we made a shift from internationalism to globalism, much assisted by photos of Earth from space. The more rapid transportation and communication, which was made possible by the products of the Industrial Revolution, led to world wars, but also to the breaking down of limited, purely nationalistic and provincial ways of looking at the world. The idea of world citizenship, first advanced by some Greek philosophers in the 4th and 3rd centuries BC, has now been accepted by more and more people living in the 21st century as awareness of the planet's unity and fragility has become more evident and appreciated. Just think of that photo of Earth from space, the absence of national boundaries, and a new vision of the way that the Earth is so isolated from everything else in the universe. Well, that's the idea of world citizenship. What about the idea of global government, a government for the whole world community? Some of those ancient philosophers who thought about world citizenship also thought a little bit about the desirability of a government for the whole world. And that idea has not been totally forgotten. The Italian author Dante Alighieri, or usually just called Dante, living from 1265 to 1321, argued that the Christian ideal of human unity and the end of war is a goal which requires having a world government ruled by a king or monarch. He argued that if disputes arose between two rulers, the only way of resolving them without war was to have one ruler of superior authority to determine what would be done in this situation of conflict. German philosopher Immanuel Kant, 1724 to 1804, the end of the Enlightenment, was a central figure in developing the idea of a world government, as well as of world citizenship, or what he called cosmopolitanism. He firmly opposed Dante's idea of a single authoritarian ruler over the world. After all, he was living in the Enlightenment and the changeover to democracy. He thought that ultimately it would be desirable to have a republic over the whole world. But he also thought that the best which could be hoped for at the time when he lived was a confederation of republican governments, which would protect the rights of all of the people in them. The idea that he formed was very similar to our United Nations, except that only democratic nation states would be allowed to be members, in Kant's view. As a result of the development and use of atomic weapons at the end of World War II in 1945, new organizations were formed, such as the United World Federalists, an organization which argued that the Confederal United Nations did not go far enough, and that the world needed a real government, a federal world government. Now, the key difference between a confederation such as the United Nations and a world federation is that in a confederation, the national governments retain unlimited sovereignty. They still control absolutely everything that happens within their boundaries, like Nazi Germany did. We in this country should know about the big transition between confederation and federation that was made in our own country. In a couple of years, 1787 to 1789, when we went from the Articles of Confederation, where there were 13 colonies, each with unlimited sovereignty, to the Constitution of the United States of America, where some of the sovereignty of the individual states was subordinated to the authority of the federal government. The U.S. Civil War decided that the United States would remain a federal union rather than reverting to a confederation of states. You may remember that the South was the Confederacy, and Lincoln always talked about the North as the Union, the Federation. And that was one of the main principles fought about in the Civil War. World Federalists say that the world as a whole should make the same kind of change at the global level, so that the relation between the nations of the world would be more like the relation that we have between our own states. The European Union is seeking to make that same kind of change within Europe, but their progress toward that goal of federation is very gradual, partly because they have a very, very difficult problem with many different languages, 24 different national languages. The slow progress of the Europeans and other continents like Africa and South America toward creating regional federations makes it evident that development of a world federation is not something that's likely to happen very soon. But that doesn't mean that it's not a worthy goal. Furthermore, many matters confronting our global community at this time show that such a major change in the governance structure of our world community needs to be considered now. Modern science and technology continue to develop more destructive weaponry even than the atomic bombs that were used in 1945, including now both bigger and smaller bombs which use nuclear fusion instead of fission. Also, there are biological and biochemical weapons of mass destruction which now exist and which are much easier and cheaper to build and develop than nuclear weapons. What if some terrorist groups get their hands on these chemical weapons? There are also new kinds of weapons being developed all the time, such as lasers and drones and robots, robotic soldiers, and new kinds of cyber warfare. As happened in both world wars, we won't be aware of how devastating these new weapons can be until after actual fighting begins and one side decides to do anything necessary to keep from losing the war. We have already been very lucky one time, 1962. During the Cuban Missile Crisis. Those of you who lived through that may remember how everyone was glued to their radios and televisions what is going to happen. And in fact, humanity was saved from annihilation by Khrushchev's decision to back down during the confrontation between the Soviet Union and the United States. Now, consequently, he lost his leadership position in the Soviet Union, but he deserves the gratitude of all humanity for the fact that we didn't have a nuclear war in 1962. Besides the possibility of war, humanity also confronts other huge problems, such as a growing amount of pollution, the global warming, the depletion of essential resources, problems which the national governments seem unable to deal with, as they insist on acting only on the basis of their short-term national interests. That's the kind of international system we have, each national government looking out just for itself and not for all of humanity. Another important aspect of the existing international system, one that doesn't get as much attention, is the economic competition between various national governments and between the separate business enterprises in different countries. Within countries, this competition is regulated by the national laws, which aim to protect the environment, tax the businesses for the benefits which they receive, and protect the rights of the workers. If there were a world government, it could enact the same kind of regulations at the global level to protect the global environment, to tax the businesses for the benefits they enjoy, and protect the rights of employees in all countries. What happens when there's no elected world government to regulate the economic competition and protect the interests of the workers? Without a global government, the people are at the mercy of the transnational corporations as they play the national governments off against each other. Which government will tax them the least, give them the most subsidies, and put the fewest regulations on them to protect the environment or the rights of their workers? The result of this is that businesses get ever more profits. There's a lack of concern about protecting the environment and the rights of the workers. This also means that there's an increasing gap between the rich and the poor, both within nations and in the world as a whole, as the corporations play their game and don't get regulated by any kind of government. International commerce would also be facilitated by having a single international currency. As someone who just went through this when I went to Uruguay and then Argentina, and when I got back home, what did I find out? That the money I had, Argentina money I had, which I saved thinking I was going to be able to convert it to US dollars, no, Argentinian money is no good anymore. No more exchange. So the money that I tried to save is worthless. We need some kind of international currency. Now, the European Union has gotten their euro going, and yet they haven't even been able to get all the countries of Europe to accept it. So it would be fairly difficult to have a single global currency until we have some kind of world government. That's going to be a necessary prerequisite to having a global currency. On the other hand, fortunately, little by little, some very important changes are being made in our global governance structures. One of them is the creation of the International Criminal Court, which was created by a treaty, the Rome Statute of 1998. The International Criminal Court has the authority to prosecute individual national and national political and military leaders for committing crimes of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. And in a couple of years, aggression will also be added. Unfortunately, this important court is not getting the support which it needs from many national governments, including the government of the United States. Fortunately, President Obama has been much more sympathetic toward the International Criminal Court than previous presidents, like Bush, who unsigned the treaty, but it's still the case that he can't submit it to the Senate for ratification because it won't get ratified. Another new idea being advanced for national governments is the responsibility to protect principle, which theoretically gives other members of the UN the right to intervene when a national government fails to protect the rights of its own people. And in fact, both the General Assembly and the Security Council have unanimously supported this principle of the responsibility to protect. The problem is the continuing distance between the stated theory and what actually happens in practice. I've criticized the United States, but on the other hand, I want to say one reason that it's not more evident that we need a world government is that the very powerful United States government sometimes does what a world government would be able to do, usually with the assistance of NATO. If it weren't for the overwhelming power of the United States, we would be much more aware of the need for a world government. But it also means that it's twisted to do what's in the best interest of the United States, not what's in the best interest of the world as a whole. One of the greatest concerns people tend to have with regard to the idea of a federal world government is the danger that it could become a world tyranny, and one person could become a dictator over the whole world. This is a regular critique that's brought up against the idea of world government, although people don't realize how close Hitler came to becoming a dictator over the whole world. If the Germans had developed nuclear weaponry before we did, it would have been a different story. We were just lucky. Furthermore, people had the same kind of concern when the United States of America was created. There was a real fear that George Washington would become another tyrannical King George, just like the King of England that had been the enemy during the Revolutionary War. Because of that concern, our founding fathers made a concerted effort to make sure that the Constitution called for an election of the president every 4 years, plus representatives in the House being elected every 2 years, and senators chosen by state legislatures every 6 years. What they didn't foresee was the influence of money, which we have at the present time. The Constitution also contained checks and balances between the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of government, as well as between the state governments and the new federal national government. But there was considerable opposition to the creation of the United States of America, and we got the United States of America largely because in the convention in New York, the vote for ratification passed by two votes. If two people had voted, by three votes, if two people had voted the other way, New York would not have ratified. If New York had not ratified, it's questionable whether New England being divided from the rest, whatever, it's debatable whether we would have had a United States of America. It was that close. In chapter 6 of my book, World Federation? I respond to the various objections I found to the World Federalist ideal. One proposal I made is to have the world government under the control of a five-person executive council rather than a single president. The world could be divided into 8 or 9 regions or continents of relatively homogeneous cultural characteristics, and it could be stipulated that no two members of the executive council could come from the same region. A rotational system could be adopted so that each member of the council, executive council, would serve as the chair for a limited period of time, maybe 3 months, and then it would go to another one. Each year, one new member could be elected to the executive council for a 5-year term by the World Parliament, and there would be a limit of 2 terms on any person on the executive council. Such a ruling executive council would be somewhat similar to the executive system which already exists in Switzerland. I think that such a system would provide substantial assurance that the world government could not be taken over by a dictator. What we need to do is have the right kind of principles when we enact the government. When a federal world government is created, the Constitution should contain a Bill of Rights for individuals and also a Bill of Rights for national governments. Like any other government, a world government would have the power to do good things or to do bad things. That's the nature of government. So the challenge for us is to think about how to establish a world government that does good things. Our present day transition from internationalism to globalism is important for each of us. Each of us should continue to think of ourselves first as citizens of the world community, and only secondarily as citizens of this country. Just as we now usually think of ourselves first as citizens of the United States and only secondarily as citizens of Illinois or Missouri. With regard to community loyalty, our concern should be for what is good for our country, but it should be subordinated to what's good for the whole world community. Simultaneously, we should do whatever we can to help transform the sometimes ineffective UN into a democratic world federation, just as our national founding fathers transformed the often ineffective Articles of Confederation into the federally structured United States of America. What I failed to mention, we had wars starting to develop between our various colonies, between New Jersey and New York, between Connecticut and Pennsylvania. There were actually 1,000 casualties from a war when some settlers from Connecticut went into Pennsylvania. In order to do our part in assisting this transition from internationalism to globalism, we should support UU non-governmental organizations like our UN office, as well as other non-governmental organizations, such as Amnesty International, the Sierra Club, Doctors Without Borders, Heifer International, Human Rights Watch, and so on. These non-governmental organizations are the bridge that we need during this transition from nationalism to internationalism to globalism. Our UUA sixth principle of promoting the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all will not be easily accomplished. It's not something we can do quickly. But it is the kind of goal we need. a goal that will keep challenging us and our children and our grandchildren and even generations after that. It is also a goal that challenges each of us at this very critical moment in human history as we ourselves live through this exciting monumental transition of our human community from an internationalistic community to a global community. Now let us sing together hymn 212. It's called We'll Build a Land, but we're going to change that word land to world. We'll build a world. So every time you see the word land, sing world. 212. I'm sorry, 121. Got a typo error there. Okay, thank you very much. 121.